All right, y'all. We have obviously a very small crew tonight, so if you want to, feel free to come closer. Don't be shy. You don't have to sit in the back, but you're welcome to do so if you'd like to. So this is our last session on C.S. Lewis. I can't believe we're already on week four. I want to thank Dana for doing hospitality these last 4 weeks. She's been very, very generous with her time. Yeah, thank you, Dana. I would also thank Ryan, because he's done the last, 8 weeks of tech, but he's not here tonight, so. But, if you see him, say thank you, for sure. I also want to say thank you to Kimball and Sue for your generosity with your time prepping for all this, and Sue for bringing treats tonight, and Turkish Delight was one of the highlights, I think, on the second week. So thank you guys very much, and thank you, everybody, for showing up throughout the course. If you're interested, by the way, our next series is going to be on theology of the body, and that's going to be running in mid-May to mid-June. We're going to we'll meet in person here, and then we're going to zoom in this wonderful guy, Dr. Michael Therrien, I think is his last name, who has a PhD, and I've talked with him a bit. He's really wonderful. So mid-May to mid-June, we'll meet here. We'll zoom him in. But tonight, we are going to go over The Magician's Nephew, if I'm not mistaken, and then The Great Divorce. But before we get into that, I'm going to say a quick prayer. So if you want to bow your heads, I'll bless our evening together. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen. Father, hear our prayers for the salvation of the world. Grant mercy to all souls that turned away from you. Open their hearts and minds with your light. Gather your children from the east and the west, from the north and the south. Have mercy, God, on those who do not know you. Bring them out of darkness into your light. You are our saving God who leads us in our salvation. Protect us from evil. We bless and praise you, O Lord. Hear our prayers and answer us. You, our Savior, are the hope of all the ends of the earth and the distant seas. May your way be known upon earth. Among all nations, your salvation. We place the world in your hands. Fill us with your love and grant us peace through Christ our Lord. Amen. In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. All right, let's welcome up Kimball for our last evening.
Well, thank you, Zach. It's always good to start a meeting with a question. Now, I have a theory that at any session, it's very likely that it's somebody's birthday. Does anybody here tonight have a birthday? If today's your birthday, please raise your hand. Whoa, we've got one. Happy birthday, Mary. Okay. Well, Sue knew it was your birthday, instinctively. Okay. So when we're young, we ask a lot of life's big questions. Why are we here? Where did evil come from? How did the world get here? What happens when we die? Are we alone? Are there other worlds like ours? What is time? What is truth? These are metaphysical questions. What are metaphysical questions? Well, they're questions that are concerned with the fundamental nature of reality, of life itself, of being. Metaphysics is a study of the principles that seek to explain and describe everything that is. And the relationships between different parts of reality, mind and matter, substance and attribute, potentiality and actuality. The term metaphysics comes from the Greek words meaning after or behind or among the physical, the natural. The term was originally used to refer to a treatise by Aristotle that followed his work on physics. So we had physics, metaphysics. Metaphysics operate in an intellectual space that is necessarily ignored by the empirical sciences and linguistics because it deals with things that are outside objective experience. Science wants to deal with what we can measure, quantify, or assess. Metaphysics goes deeper and beyond to find patterns and realities that help to organize that scientific inquiry and provide a deeper meaning. So as important and valuable and compelling as science is to our physical well-being, standing alone, it's incomplete. It's necessary but not sufficient. It cannot and doesn't answer those kinds of questions that I started with. If for no other reason, then that's not what science does. Science leaves us longing for something more. So to continue our metaphor of looking at versus looking along the beam, science is kind of like looking at the beam. Science, physics, metaphysics tends to be more of the reality that's in the beam or along the beam. Science and metaphysics both can become intimidating. And frankly, at times a bit off-putting. Some of us really aren't attracted to scientific inquiry at all, or metaphysical inquiry. And they both have the power to amaze and to stun us into humility. Humility is a virtue that comes when the slide advance doesn't work. That's interesting. Oh, there we go. So, like Kimball, Job found wisdom through humility. So we remember the story of Job, an ancient biblical story, one of the oldest, and formed around metaphysical questions and principles. And ironically, it's only with the submission that Job has at the end of a long inquiry into why he had been treated the way he was. He was a virtuous man and subjected to horrible parade of negative things. Probably worse than anything we could possibly experience and still survive and maintain any kind of objective sense of hope. And ultimately, Job's wisdom came from acknowledging that he wasn't God, that he didn't know anything. He had pridefully thought that by following all the laws, perhaps the laws of human nature, that he was virtuous and should be rewarded, and somehow he wasn't, paradoxically. And at the end, he's humbled and repents. And speaking to God, he says, My ears had heard you. In other words, he had looked at God at the beam or with his mind, but now my eyes have seen you. He felt and experienced God in his heart. He was looking along the beam. And therefore I retract my words and I repent in dust and ashes. He had accused God of being unreasonable and unfair. And God, ultimately, that's all he wants to hear. And at the end of the story, he looks to Job's friends who had been trying to school him about why he had done what he had done and why it was that he had been punished and it was all his fault. And God turns on them and says that it's my servant Job who will pray for you. I will accept his prayer. I'm not going to listen to your prayers, for you have not spoken accurately about me as my servant Job has. So why do we talk about the story of God of Job in a conversation about C.S. Lewis? Well, I think Job is a story. And by looking at that story and experiencing those questions and wrestling with those concepts in that story, we tend to internalize and relate to them more than we do if we were trying to solve and explain that story in some sort of scientific way. The second example that I want to point to moves in the other direction. I mean, this is the science approach. I was at an airport looking for something to read while we were waiting, and I saw this title in the bookstore. I mean, black holes had always sort of fascinated me, and wormholes, and so I bought it and started reading it. And quickly, we were talking about general relativity and quantum mechanics and areas in which most of us, at least I, navigate very uncomfortably. Black holes, with black holes, just a little bit of this, the magnetic field is so strong, it pulls everything into this hole that even light itself cannot escape, which is why they're called black holes. But if everything gets sucked into the hole so that nothing can escape, where does the matter go? I mean, we know in physics that matter can't be created or destroyed, and yet here we've got these black holes that seem to be destroying matter, destroying even light. What does science do with that? Well, science comes up with a theory. And in that theory, they start looking inside the black holes. Now, I don't know that anybody's ever been inside a black hole and returned. But they came up with this idea that, well, to explain this all, maybe the matter didn't disappear, that somehow it was connected to some other reality. And so they posited the existence of wormholes. You can see the slides aren't too good, but the upper one on the right, you can see kind of a wormhole going from one continuous universe that's connected around behind to another universe. And so now we have the potential that the problem has been solved, this question has been solved, the paradox has been solved, but they did it with a story, which I find kind of interesting. They solved the physical problem metaphysically. And that requires kind of a faith and trust in their new story. And we've been navigating in the imaginative story world and in our faith with faith and trust, based on reason, not outside of reason, but science itself can operate in faith in a way outside of reason. So all of that just by way of introduction to The Magician's Nephew. I mean, why talk about this in relation to The Magician's Nephew? Well, in part because wormholes or movement between universes and worlds is a central part of the story of The Magician's Nephew. And that these ideas of both metaphysics and physics and reality and storytelling and good and evil all resonate and come together in the narrative of story in a way that's much easier to approach, to dwell in, to enjoy. There's a truth that lurks in the background of these stories. We have, in our faith, we have a story of God coming down from heaven. Emmanuel, God is with us, from heaven to our world. That is not too distant from this idea of transference between universes. There's a deeper wisdom present there, a wisdom that we can't logically explain, and yet in our hearts we can experience and know. And from Lewis's perspective, the best way to do that is in story. So the focus here is not on the how of the travel between universes. For storytelling purposes, the actual movement itself is just something that happens. We accept it as a part of a story, unquestioningly. It's a part of our imaginative reality. It stretches our imagination, but somehow we can keep up with it, which is a part of what distinguishes the human mind from all the other species. What are some of the risks that show up in this story? They look at questions of ethics and moral behavior, a creation itself, good and evil, temptation, old and dying worlds, new worlds, magic, wisdom, faith, and gratitude. All these elements are present in The Magician's Nephew. As we'll later consider The Great Divorce a little bit, some of those same themes are treated in a different way. There's a great chasm that separates heaven and hell. Remember the story of Abraham and Lazarus and his master. The difference between reality and appearance, the difference between truth and deception, the roles that pride and prejudice play in our ultimate saving reality or damnation, the freedom to decide how and where we will live in eternity, and the strange and ironic choices that most of the characters in The Great Divorce make as they exercise that freedom. Not the choice that you would hope that they would make, but the choice that most actually do. So we only have time tonight. We're trying to cover two books. I want to give you the story of The Magician's Nephew, just so you actually understand the story, with a little bit of Lewis to give you the real look along the beam, the way he writes it. But I'll leave the riches of most of the storytelling to your own discovery. I mean, it's as you read these stories, and if you read them more than one time, more than just to find out what happens, to read them to think about what's behind what happened, which is why Lewis, after all, wrote the stories. He wasn't just telling what happened. He was getting us to think, using our imagination, about these important issues. So what happens in The Magician's Nephew? The story begins in London during the summer of 1900. Two children, Diggory Kirk and Polly Plummer, meet while they're playing in the adjacent gardens of a row of terraced houses. And they decide to explore the empty attic above Diggory's house, and they navigate their way along, and it's dark, and they think they know where they are, but they don't. And they come out in Uncle Andrew's study. Now, who's Uncle Andrew? Well, he's Diggory's uncle, and he fancies himself a genius and a magician, and he's been playing with some magic dust that he inherited. And he made some rings from that dust, and the dust was rumored to have come from the disappeared island of Atlantis. And the rings may be entangled in some way, just as the universes in the Scientific American analysis that entangled one reality and one universe with another. These rings may be entangled a little bit with some of Atlantis, but I'll leave that up to you. So he made two sets of rings, a yellow ring that would take you away and a green ring that would bring you back. But Uncle Andrew really didn't know where away was, and he really didn't know if the green ring would bring you back. So he tied a yellow ring to a guinea pig, and the guinea pig disappeared. And he didn't know where it went, So he decided he needed some human guinea pigs who could understand about the rings and go away and come back again. And so now, here all of a sudden are Diggory and Polly magically appearing at his doorstep. So he tricks Polly into touching the yellow ring. Poof, Polly's gone. And Diggory said, bring her back. I can't bring her back. She didn't take the green ring with her. He explains that the yellow rings take you and the green rings bring you back. And he says, Diggory, I guess you're going to have to go and bring her back. And Diggory says, why don't you go? And he says, no, I'm a scientist. I'm an important person. This isn't for me. This is for you. Well, Diggory is justifiably angry about that situation. But he finally decides, what if Mom says I'm not going to be home for dinner? And Uncle Andrew says, the sooner you go, the sooner you can come back. So you better get going. And so poor Diggory obediently takes two yellow rings and two green rings, and he finds himself transported to a different world. It's a sleepy woodland. And let's see how Lewis describes this area. Uncle Andrew and his study vanished instantly. And then for a moment, everything became muddled. The next thing Diggory knew was that there was a soft green light coming down on him from above and darkness below. He didn't seem to be standing on anything or sitting or lying. Nothing appeared to be touching him. I believe I'm in water, said Diggory, or underwater. And this frightened him for a second, but almost at once he could feel that he was rushing upward, and then his head suddenly came out into the air, and he found himself scrambling ashore out onto smooth, grassy ground at the edge of a pool. As he rose to his feet, he noticed that he was neither dripping nor panting for breath, as anyone would expect after being underwater. His clothes were perfectly dry. He was standing by the edge of a small pool and not more than 10 feet from side to side in a wood. The trees grew close together and were so leafy that he could get no glimpse of the sky. All the light was green light that came through the leaves, but there must have been a very strong sun overhead, for this green daylight was bright and warm. It was the quietest wood you could possibly imagine. There were no birds, no insects, no animals, no wind. You could almost feel the trees growing. The pool he had just got out of was not the only pool. There were dozens of others, a pool every few yards as far as his eyes could reach. You could almost feel the trees drinking the water up with their roots. This wood was very much alive. And when he tried to describe it afterwards, Diggory always said, it was a rich place, rich as plum cake. The strangest thing was that almost before he had looked about him, Diggory had half forgotten how he had come there. At any rate, he was certainly not thinking about Polly or Uncle Andrew or even his mother. He was not in the least frightened or excited or curious. If anyone had asked him, where did you come from? He probably would have said, I've always been here. That was the way it felt like, as if one had always been in that place and never been bored, although nothing had ever happened. As he said long afterwards, it's not the sort of place where things happen. The trees go on growing, that's all. After Diggory had looked at the wood for a long time, he noticed that there was a girl lying on her back at the foot of a tree a few yards away. Her eyes were nearly shut, but not quite, as if she were just been between sleeping and waking. So he looked at her for a long time and said nothing, and at last she opened her eyes and looked at him for a long time, and she also said nothing, and then she spoke in a dreamy, contented sort of voice. I think I've seen you before, she said. I rather think so, too, said Diggory. Have you been here long? Oh, always, said the girl. At least, I don't know, a very long time. So have I, said Diggory. No, you haven't, said she. I've just seen you come out of that pool. Well, yeah, I suppose I did, said Diggory, with a puzzled air. I'd forgotten. And then for quite a long time, neither said anything more. Look here, said the girl presently. I wonder, did we ever really meet before? I had a sort of idea, a sort of picture in my head of a boy and a girl like us living somewhere quite different and doing all sorts of things. Perhaps it was only a dream. Yeah, I've had that same dream, I think, said Diggory, about a boy and a girl living next door and something about crawling among rafters. I remember the girl had a dirty face. Well, why aren't you getting it mixed in my dream? It was the boy who had the dirty face. Well, I can't remember the boy's face, said Diggory, and then he added, hello, what's that? Why, it's a guinea pig, said the girl. And it was a fat guinea pig, nosing around in the grass. But round the middle of the guinea pig, there ran a tape. And tied onto it by the tape was a bright yellow ring. Look, look, cried Diggory, the ring. And look, you've got one on your finger, and so have I. And the girl now sat up, really interested at last. And they stared very hard at one another, trying to remember. And then, at exactly the same moment, she shouted out, Mr. Ketterly, and he shouted out, Uncle Andrew, and they knew who they were and began to remember the whole story. After a few minutes of hard talking, they had got it straight. Diggory explained how beastly Uncle Andrew had been. Well, what do we do now, said Polly, take the guinea pig and go home? Yeah, there's no hurry, said Diggory with a huge yawn. And there temptation begins. There would have been no story if Diggory had done what he was supposed to do, just take Polly and head home. But oh no, no, Diggory wanted to, well, we can go back anytime. We've got the yellow rings, we've got the green rings, we can go back and forth, we can have some fun, we can go out on the town, we can see all sorts of things. And so off they go. And they jump into one of the pools. And from the pool, they emerge, and they emerge in a different place. It's a land with a red dying sun. Polly had tried to restrain Diggory, but Diggory elbowed her out of the way, and off they go. And they find in this land a ruined palace, and they discovered statues of rulers, of former kings and queens, all lined up in a row. And the statues gradually degenerate and decline from noble, fair, and wise kings and queens to unhappy and cruel kings and queens. And they look around and they discover a bell with a hammer and an obscure and tempting riddle-like inscription. This is where Tolkien and Lewis kind of had a simpatico. They loved poetry and bringing poetry into the story. So this riddle was, make your choice, adventurous stranger, strike the bell and bide the danger. Or wonder till it drives you mad what would have happened if you had. Diggory thinks about that. And he starts to ring, and Polly tries to stop him, but he elbows her out of the way, and boom, he strikes it. And at first, it's just this small, gentle sound, ping, ping, and it gradually gets louder and louder. And I won't demonstrate the loudness to it, but it's loud enough to start crumbling buildings. And in addition, the last statue, the most evil and the most cruel and the most unhappy, comes to life. And her name is Queen Jadis. And it turns out that Jadis had spoken the deplorable word. Now, Jadis had tried to usurp the throne from her sister, but her forces, her armies, were defeated. But there was a word, just as the word is the beginning of life in Genesis, this is the deplorable word. This is a word if anyone speaks it, will end the world forever and kill everyone else in it except the person who utters the word. And Jairus is not going to get what she wants. And so she speaks the deplorable word. And the world, the kingdom of Charn, starts to collapse. And everything's exploding around them as the buildings collapse and there's dust. And she then uses magic to pause the word or the destruction and put it in the bell, which Diggory just rang, which brings her back to life. She's the only survivor in that whole world. The children quickly recognize that she's evil and they try to escape and run away, but she's too quick and too smart, and she chases them, stays with them, and when they try to put their rings on, she grabs a hold of them, and they go back to the wood between the world, but now Jairus is with them. Interestingly, in the wood between the world, Jairus's power, she's this big, tall, strong woman, but in the wood between the world, she's weak and sickly and gasping for breath and finds it hard to believe. Diggory and Polly try to escape and go dive back in the pool to go back to London, but Jairus grabs a hold and back she goes to London with them. Now all of a sudden we've got Queen Jairus in London dealing with Uncle Andrew, who she quickly realizes created the magic, but is a sniveling, cowardly, wimpy guy. But he just thinks she's magnificent. And he puts on his best clothes to try to see if she'll go out with him. And she doesn't have too much to do with Uncle Andrew. And I won't go into all the details, but they're humiliating. Jairus is trying to, she wants servants. She wants a chariot. And so she orders Andrew to go get a chariot for her. So he flags down a handsome cab with an old hackneyed horse pulling it along. And Jairus jumps on that and starts wheeling the cab all around town. And she decides she needs some jewelry. So she goes to a jewelry store and she just gets the jewelry because she's entitled to jewelry because she's a queen. But the police then come and there's this incredible fracas in front of the house, and Diggory realizes that he's caused this horrible thing and he needs to bring an end to it. And so he puts the rings back on. Jairus grabs him, but at the same time, the cabbie and the horse are all connected as well. And so whew, off they go back into the wood between the world. And then Strawberry, the horse, is thirsty. So he starts to drink in a pool, and that pool then whoosh, takes them to a different universe, down another wormhole. And this universe is totally black and dark and empty and void. There's no light. There's no sound. It's like a black hole. And Diggory thinks they've made it back to Charn that's been totally destroyed. But Jairus recognized that that's not the case. In fact, they're in a world that's not yet created. It's a world that is about to be created. And it's about to be created by Aslan. In the darkness, something was happening at last. A voice had begun to sing. It was very far away, and Diggory found it hard to decide from which direction it was coming. Sometimes it seemed to come from all directions at once. Sometimes he almost thought it was coming out of the earth beneath them. Its lower notes were deep enough to be the voice of the earth herself. There were no words. There was hardly even a tune, but it was beyond comparison the most beautiful noise he had ever heard. It was so beautiful he could hardly bear it. The horse seemed to like it too. He gave the sort of whinny a horse would give if after years of being a cab horse it found itself back in the old field where it had played as a foal and saw someone whom it remembered and loved coming across the field to bring him a lump of sugar. Then two wonders happened at the same moment. One was that the voice was suddenly joined by other voices, more voices than you could possibly count. They were in harmony with it, but far higher up the scale, cold, tingling, silvery voices. The second wonder was that the blackness overhead all at once was blazing with stars. They didn't come out gently one by one as they do on a summer evening. One moment there had been nothing but darkness. Next moment, 1,000 points of light leaped out. Single stars, constellations, planets brighter, bigger than any in our world. There were no clouds. The new stars and the new voices began at exactly the same time. If you had seen and heard it, as Diggory did, you would have felt quite certain that it was the stars themselves which were singing, and that it was the first voice, the deep one, which had made them appear and made them sing. The voice on the earth was now louder and more triumphant, but the voices in the sky, after singing loudly with it for a time, began to get fainter, and now something else was happening. Far away and down near the horizon, the sky began to turn gray. A light wind, very fresh, began to stir. The sky in that one place grew slowly and steadily paler. You could see shapes of hills standing up dark against it. All the time, the voice went on singing. There was soon light enough for them to see one another's faces. The cabbie and the two children had open mouths and shining eyes. They were drinking in the sound, and they looked as if it reminded them of something. Uncle Andrew's mouth was open too, but not open with joy. He looked more as if his chin had simply dropped away from the rest of his face. His shoulders were stooped and his knees shook. He was not liking the voice. If he could have got away from it by creeping into a rat's hole, he would have done so. But the witch looked as if, in a way, she understood the music better than any of them. Her mouth was shut. Her lips were pressed together and her fists were clenched. Ever since the song began, she had felt that this whole world was filled with a magic different from hers and stronger. She hated it. She would have smashed the whole world or all worlds to pieces if it would only stop the singing. The horse stood with its ears well forward and twitching. Every now and then it snorted and stamped the ground. It no longer looked like a tired old cab horse. You could see now, you could now well believe that its father had been in battles. The eastern sky changed from white to pink and from pink to gold. The voice rose and rose till all the air was shaking with it. And just as it swelled to the mightiest and most glorious sound it had yet produced, the sun arose. Diggory had never seen such a sun. The sun above the ruins of Charn had looked older than ours. This looked younger. You could imagine that it laughed for joy as it came up, and as its beam shot across the land, the travelers could see for the first time what sort of place they were in. It was a valley through which a broad, swift river wound its way, flowing eastward toward the sun. Southward there were mountains, northward there were lower hills, but it was a valley of mere earth, rock and water. There was not a tree nor a bush, not a blade of grass to be seen. The earth was of many colors. They were fresh, hot, and vivid. They made you feel excited until you saw the singer himself, and then you forgot everything else. It was a lion, huge, shaggy, and bright. It stood facing the sun. Its mouth was wide open in song, and it was about 300 yards away. Well, the story goes on, and the world is created, the grasses, the trees, everything, the flowers, it all comes to life. And it's a glorious world. But Jadis is terrified by it, and she's terrified by Aslan, and she still has her grip on that piece of the lamppost that she had torn off to beat away the police and everyone else. And she throws it at Aslan while he's creating this world. And it bounces off him. He doesn't even notice. But it falls in the ground. And as everything's being created and everything comes to life, this piece of a lamppost grows into a lamppost. And that's the lamppost that Lucy saw when she went through the wardrobe and came into Narnia. in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and that's how it got there. When Jadis is unable to hurt Aslan, she flees in terror. And the birth of the new world continues. Ultimately, Aslan, after the world's created, confronts Diggory with his responsibility for bringing Jadis and evil into this new world that he had created. Here's this new world. Everything's perfect, and yet evil has come into it. And this is a story of how that happened. Aslan tells Diggory that he must atone for what he'd done by helping to protect the new land from the evil that Jadis represents. Aslan transformed Strawberry, the cabbie's tired and beaten down horse, into a magnificent winged steed that he names Fledge. And Diggory and Polly hop onto Fledge to fly for many days to a distant garden high in the mountains. And their job is to obtain an apple from a tree that's planted in the garden at the top of the mountain and bring it back. We think of that apple in Genesis in a very different kind of way. We think of the apple as on the tree of good and evil, and eating the apple causes sin to enter our world. Here, sin has entered the world, and Lewis is playing with that theme almost as if it's a kind of musical, symphonic sort of thing. And he's turning the apple around where the apple can be good. But the apple can also be evil. If you eat the apple in the way it's not intended, it can be harmful to you. So Diggory plucks the apple, and as he's doing so, he realizes that Jadis has made her way all the way across this land that they'd flown over. She had a couple days head start. And when she came to the wall, she jumped the wall instead of going through the gate. And if we remember scriptural allusions about you have to go through the gate, you can't go over the wall. These themes are all kind of woven in ways that if you're not aware of them, you don't see them. And she wanted the apple because it would give her immortality. And so she eats the apple. And it appears that she does gain immortality, but all the color drains out of her body, giving her the white appearance that she has in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. She tempts Diggory to eat an apple himself and join her in immortality, similar to what she did with Edmund, where she promised, and Edmund succumbed to that. But Diggory does not. At least at first, he knows what Aslan's told him to do, and he thinks he should do it, and he will do it. And Aslan told him to bring one back for Aslan. And Jadis says, well, why don't you bring one back for your dying mother? Just take another one and bring it back. So now Diggory's got this dilemma. Do I do what Aslan told me, or do I solve things myself? If I'm Abraham, do I go to Egypt with my slave, or do I have my child with my wife who's too old? Well, Abraham thinks he's going to solve it himself, and that doesn't work out too well for Abraham. Diggory is really tempted, but he resists the temptation because he knows his mother wouldn't condone thievery. I mean, that's the thing that stops him, is that Mom said it would be wrong, so he's going to obey, but the witch is still tempting him. And finally she says, look, we can leave that girl behind. And then Diggory realizes that she doesn't know that Polly has a ring, and Polly can go back all by herself. Polly doesn't need them. And he realizes that she's evil. And knowing that fact, he hops back on Fledge, and the witch runs away. The witch eating the apple is repulsed by the smell and the taste and the presence of the apple. And that's the reason why Aslan sent Diggory there to get it. So he would bring it back, which he does, and plant it in the soil. And from that soil will grow a tree. And the tree will be such a stench to Jadis that she'll stay away for 1,000 years. But not forever. It's kind of like Jesus being tempted and the devil left him for a time. And we know that Jadis comes back as after 1,000 years. In 1,000 years, that's what the millennialists talk about in Protestant theology. There's a kingdom that's going to last 1,000 years. So what became of the apple? And Lewis tells it this way. It was like this. The tree which sprang from the apple that Diggory planted in the back garden lived and grew into a fine tree, growing in the soil of our world, far out of the sound of Aslan's voice, and far from the young heir of Narnia. It did not bear apples that would revive a dying woman as Diggory's mother had been revived. Sorry, I skipped a part. Diggory comes back. The tree grows in Narnia. Aslan allows Diggory to take one of the apples because he did what he'd been told. And so there's the grace that he can take some of the first fruits from that apple and bring them back for his mother, which he does. His mother eats the apple, she recovers, and Diggory takes the core and plants it out in his backyard. And that's what I was starting to read from. Though it did bear apples, this is the tree that sprang up from the core that was planted back in England. The apples were more beautiful than any others in England, and they were extremely good for you, though not fully magical. But inside itself, in the very sap of it, the tree, so to speak, never forgot that other tree in Narnia to which it belonged. Sometimes it would move mysteriously when there was no wind blowing, a kind of entanglement. I think that when this happened, there were high winds in Narnia, and the English tree quivered because at that moment the Narnia tree was rocking and swaying in a strong southwestern gale. However that might be, it was proved later that there was still magic in its woods, for when Diggory was quite middle-aged, and he was a famous learned man, a professor, and a great traveler by that time, and the Ketterleys' old house belonged to him, there was a great storm over all of the south of London which blew the tree down. Diggory couldn't bear to have it simply chopped up for firewood, and so he had part of the timber made into a wardrobe, which he put in his big house in the country. And though he himself did not discover the magic properties of that wardrobe, someone else did. And that was the beginning of all the comings and goings between Narnia and our world, which you can read of in other books, Lewis says. But even after all of that, at the end of the nephew, the magician and his nephew, Lewis concludes as follows. When Diggory and his people went to live in the big country house, they took Uncle Andrew to live with them. For Diggory's father said, "We must try to keep the odd fellow out of mischief, and it isn't fair that poor Letty, his sister, should have them always on her hands." Uncle Andrew never tried any magic again as long as he lived. He had learned his lesson. And in his old age, he became a nicer and less selfish old man than he had ever been before. But he always liked to get visitors alone in the billiard room and tell them stories about a mysterious lady, a foreign royalty with whom he had driven all about London. A devilish temper she had, he would say, but she was a damn fine woman, sir, a damn fine woman. And thus ends the magician's nephew. So there's some autobiographical elements in the story. There, remember, as we talked last time, Lewis's mother had died when he was young. And Diggory's mother was very ill and coming close to dying. Diggory became a professor. Lewis was a professor. He took in evacuated children. Lewis took in evacuated children. The character of Uncle Andrew resembles Robert Capron, the headmaster at the Wynyard School that we talked about last time, who was such a horrible, beastly man. There are themes of metaphysical themes of Genesis in The Magician's Nephew. In the other Narnia Chronicles, we get the passion story that we visited in the first episode, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. We're not going to be able to get to the last battle, the Omega, but there we have the end of time, the Alpha and the Omega. Why the title, The Magician's Nephew? Well, we have the Son of God and the Son of Man, and here we have the Magician's Nephew, an interesting play on those words. It's kind of like the twists and turns that Lewis uses in the Screwtape Letters. Evil's depicted in two ways. It's depicted as a kind of despicable evil that Uncle Andrew represents, that just selfish, venal, I'm better than everybody else, the rules don't apply to me, I get what I want, everybody else serves me. And then there's the manifest evil that Jadis represents, that she's just really pure evil. Jadis, Uncle Andrew, are both willing to sacrifice everybody and anybody instead of sacrificing themselves. It's all just upside down and backward. There's pride, there's mischief. All these things are happening. There's a failure to follow the law of human nature, what we talked about in Mere Christianity. There's the redeeming importance of the family and the love of family. All these themes are woven throughout. There's a difference between wisdom and cleverness, between knowledge and wisdom, between physics and metaphysics. Joseph Pierce recently said, there's a world of difference between wisdom and cleverness. In fact, truth be told, there's much more than a world of difference between them, because what separates wisdom and cleverness can become the abyss that separates heaven from hell. The devil's much cleverer than we are, but few would consider making an eternal enemy of God an act of wisdom. So we've got some time. Let's move to the Great Divorce. The Great Divorce is the divorce, the separation of heaven and hell. The whole difficulty of understanding hell is that the thing to be understood is so nearly nothing. Heaven is everything true and real. Hell is the absence of everything true and real, the separation of everything true and real. In this story, which we learn at the end of it is a dream, there's a narrator, which is Lewis, and he finds himself in a gray town, dark, dusky, seems like it's twilight. And he's waiting for a bus. It's rainy, it's cold. He ultimately gets on the bus with a number of other people, all of whom are disagreeable, and he's got nothing in common with any of them. And he doesn't know why he's on the bus or what he was standing in line for, but people are trying to butt in line, and they do all the stuff about butting in line and jostling in line, and they don't even know why they're going in line, but still they're doing that. The bus is a magical bus, and all of a sudden it starts flying. And it flies from this dark, dusky area to an area that's sunny and is a new and different world. It's not a wormhole. It's not a wood between the world. It's a magic bus. It's another kind of transference between worlds that works in the imaginative creation of literature and our minds. The narrator discovers Lewis discovers that everything in this new place is motionless. Everything's rigid and hard. Even walking is hard. And part of the reason it's hard is just as hell is nothingness, Lewis's body is becoming weightless and phantom-like. And so partly the reason stepping on grass hurts is because there's no substance to him. There's no weight to him. There's nothing to push the grass down. The grass goes up into his feet, making it painful. He realizes he doesn't have a solid body, and he and the other people on the bus are phantoms of themselves with little substance. They're ghost-like. Some spirits come down from the hill, from the sun, and they have solid bodies, and they try to convince all these phantoms to come with them, to come with us to the mountain in the distance. Many of them refuse to do so. They're afraid. They can't walk. It hurts. They've got all sorts of reasons why they don't want to do it. A lot of them just go back and get on the bus. And I'm quickly passing over a lot of very interesting stories. And each of these stories is a personality type that you probably met somebody like Ikey or the big ghost or Len or the hard-bitten ghost. There are all these characters, and you've seen those characteristics, and mercifully you hope you don't have any of them yourself. But Lewis himself is a little, it's hard moving forward, and he's about to go back to the bus himself when all of a sudden George MacDonald appears. And George MacDonald was his leader in imaginative, creative literature. Lewis tried to model himself after George MacDonald. And MacDonald greets him cheerfully and promises to show him around. And he explains to Lewis that they're on vacation from hell in the Valley of the Shadow of Life. I just love the way he does these things. The gray town is the entrance to hell. Interestingly, one of the smart guys down there says that this really isn't dusk. This is dawn. Everything's about to get better. Just stick with me. I've got all the answers. Not. But the gray town leads you deeper and deeper into hell, just as this mountain area takes you, area the valley before the mountain, takes you ever closer and closer to things that are more and more solid instead of more and more separated. That the valley is almost a kind of purgatory, an entrance to heaven. It's a place to gain substance, so as you move closer, you start to gain substance. You can walk on the grass. You can even walk on water, as happens at one place in the story. For the rest of the story, MacDonald leads Lewis around this valley area, meeting, listening to conversations with many different spirits and phantoms who are there. There's a famous artist who loves his art more than anything, which stands in the way of his being able to move up the mountain. There's a female ghost who complains so much about her husband that eventually she disappears entirely. She's so petty and fussy that she no longer has a soul and disappears. There are all sorts of ghosts. But there's one in particular that I'd like to focus on. This is one with a happy ending. Most of these endings aren't so happy. So Lewis says, I saw coming towards us a ghost who carried something on his shoulder. Like all the ghosts, he was unsubstantial, but they differed from one another as smokes differ. Some had been whitish. This one was dark and oily. What sat on his shoulder was a little red lizard, and it was twitching its tail like a whip and whispering things in his ear. As we caught sight of him, he turned his head to the reptile with a snarl of impatience. Shut up, I tell you, he said. It wagged its tail and continued to whisper to him. He ceased snarling and presently began to smile. Then he turned and started to limp westward, away from the mountain. "Off so soon?" said a voice. The speaker was more or less human in shape, but larger than a man and so bright that I could hardly look at him. His presence smote on my eyes and on my body too, for there was heat coming from him as well as light, like the morning sun at the beginning of a tyrannous summer day. Yeah, I'm off, said the ghost. Thanks for all your hospitality, but, you know, it's no good. You see, I told this little chap, he indicated to the lizard, that he'd have to be quiet if he came, which he insisted on doing. Of course, his stuff won't do here. I realize that, but he won't stop. I just have to go home. Would you like me to make him quiet? Said the flaming spirit, an angel as I now understood. Of course I would, said the ghost. Well, then I will kill him, said the angel, taking a step forward. Oh, wait a minute, look out, you're burning me. Keep away, said the ghost, retreating. Don't you want him killed? Well, you didn't say anything about killing at first. I hardly meant to bother you with anything so drastic as that. It's the only way, said the angel, whose burning hands were now very close to the lizard. Shall I kill it? Well, now that's a further question. I'm quite open to consider it, but it is a new point, isn't it? I mean, for the moment, I was only thinking about silencing it because up here, well, it's all just so damned embarrassing. May I kill it? Well, we can talk about that later. There is no time. May I kill it? Please, I never meant to be such a nuisance. Please, really, don't bother. Look, it's gone to sleep of its own accord. I'm sure it'll be okay now. Thanks ever so much. May I kill it? Honestly, I don't think there's the slightest necessity for that. I'm sure I'll be able to keep it in good order now. I think the gradual process would be far better than killing it. The gradual process is of no use at all. Oh, don't you think so? Well, I'll think over what you've said very carefully. I honestly will. In fact, I'd let you kill it now, but as a matter of fact, I'm not feeling frightfully well today. It would be most silly to do it now. I'd need to be in good health for the operation, so some other day, perhaps. There is no other day. All days are present now. Get back, you're burning me. How can I tell you to kill it? You'd kill me if you did. It is not so. Why? You're hurting me now. I never said it wouldn't hurt you. I said it wouldn't kill you. Oh, I know. You think I'm a coward, but it isn't that. Really, it isn't, I say. Let me run back by tonight's bus and get an opinion from my own doctor. I'll come again the first moment I can. This moment contains all moments. Why are you torturing me? You're jeering at me. How can I let you tear me to pieces? If you wanted to help me, why didn't you kill the damn thing without asking me before I knew? It would be all over by now if you had. I cannot kill it against your will. It is impossible. Have I your permission? The angel's hands were almost closed on the lizard, but not quite. And then the lizard began chattering to the ghost so loud that even I could hear what it was saying. Be careful, it said. He can do what he says. He can kill me. One fatal word from you, and he will. Then you'll be without me forever and ever. It's not natural. How could you live? You'd only be a sort of ghost, not a real man as you are now. He doesn't understand. He's only a cold, bloodless, abstract thing. It may be natural for him, but it isn't for us. Yes, yes, I know there's no real pleasures now, only dreams, but aren't they better than nothing? And, oh, I'll be so good. I admit I've sometimes gone too far in the past, but I promise I won't do it again. I'll give you nothing but really nice dreams. All sweet and fresh and almost innocent. You might say quite innocent. Have I your permission? said the angel to the ghost. I know it will kill me. It won't, but supposing it did. You're right. It would be better to be dead than to live with this creature. Then I may? Damn it, blast you, go on, can't you get it over? Do what you like, bellowed the ghost, but ended whimpering, God help me, God help me. Next moment, the ghost gave a scream of agony such as I'd never heard on earth. The burning one closed his crimson grip on the reptile, twisted it while it bit and writhed, and then flung it, broken-backed, on the turf. Oh, that's done for me, gasped the ghost, reeling backward. For a moment, I could make out nothing distinctly, and then I saw, between me and the nearest bush, unmistakably solid, but growing every moment solider, the upper arm and the shoulder of a man. Then, brighter still and stronger, the legs and hands, the neck and golden head materialized while I watched. And in my attention, and if my attention had not wavered, I should have seen the actual completing of a man, an immense man, naked and not much smaller than the angel. What distracted me was the fact that at the same moment, something seemed to be happening to the lizard. At first, I thought the operation had failed. So far from dying, the creature was still struggling and even growing bigger as it struggled. And as it grew, it changed. Its hinder parts grew rounder. The tail, still flickering, became a tail of hair that flickered between huge and glossy buttocks. Suddenly, I started back, rubbing my eyes. What stood before me was the greatest stallion I had ever seen, silvery white, but with mane and tail of gold. It was smooth and shining, rippled with swells of flesh and muscle, a whinnying, stamping with its hoofs, and at each stamp, the land shook and the trees dwindled. The new man turned and clapped the new horse's neck. It nosed his bright body. Horse and master breathed each into each other's nostrils. The man turned from it, flung himself at the feet of the burning one and embraced them. When he rose, I thought his face shone with tears, but it may have been only the liquid love and brightness, one cannot distinguish them in that country, which flowed from him. I had not long to think about it. In joyous haste, the young man leaped upon the horse's back. Turning in his seat, he waved a farewell, then nudged the stallion with his heels. Remember, the eagle was, or the lizard was riding on him, and now he's riding on the horse. They were off before I knew well what was happening. There was riding, if you like. I came out as quickly as I could from among the bushes to follow them with my eyes, but already they were only like a shooting star far off on the green plain and soon among the foothills of the mountains. Then, still like a star, I saw them winding up, scaling what seemed impossible steeps and quicker every moment till near the dim brow of the landscape, so high that I must strain my neck to see them, they vanished, bright themselves into the rose brightness of that everlasting morning. While I watched still, I noticed that the whole plain and forest were shaking with a sound which in our world would be too large to hear. But there I could take it with joy. I knew it was not the solid people who were singing. It was the voice of that earth whose woods and those waters, those woods and those waters, a strange, archaic, inorganic noise that came from all directions at night, at once. The nature or arch nature of that land rejoiced to have won, once more ridden and therefore consummated in the person of the horse. It sang, saving one soul. A wonderful thing. But not all the stories end that happily. Most end up, sadly, going back on the bus. They want to go back for one reason or another, rather like that man coming up with all those excuses about why he shouldn't kill it. They decide that life's really better back where I'm in control, not where, like Job, I humbly submit to that deeper wisdom that somehow I know is out there. but all of what's in me wants me to solve my own way. And that, of course, is our free will. We have the freedom to decide, to say, kill it, or to leave, to get back on the bus. We know the law of human nature. We don't follow it. We know what we need to do for salvation. We tend not to do it. There's a scene with a guy named Ikey. There are glorious apples, glorious golden apples. And Ikey's got this idea. He's going to get a sack and bring back a whole bunch of them down to hell. And he's going to sell them, and he's going to make a huge profit. And so he tries to get a whole bunch of them, but he can't pick them up because they're solid and he's not. And finally he takes one, and he's dragging, because that's all they can do, and he's trying to drag it to the bus and drag it to the bus. And finally he gives up because you can't take it with you. You know, you can't bring it back with you. So I commend The Great Divorce to you. It's a story filled with characters and people like all of us, with all our human frailties. And we can see and learn from the frailties of other people, and maybe that reflection will help us learn to deal with the ones that we have ourselves. So that brings us to our conclusion, to the end of our time spent with Lewis. I've only touched on certain parts of Lewis and tried to share Lewis himself, not just me talking about Lewis, because I think that allows you to look along the beam at him, to experience him, to get the taste of his talent in telling stories and the wisdom and the strength that comes from storytelling. Much of Lewis's work is far more difficult, he writes for scholarly audiences as well as for people like you and me. But I love and am most attracted to the imaginative work. There's a kind of quiet, childlike joy that's associated with it. He talked about, remember, his descriptions of joy and how to define joy. And it was that moment of rapture when you just... everything feels as it's as it's supposed to be, and all's right with the world, and you are in it. And it's a fleeting sense, but one that I think he brings to us in his imaginative writings, not scientific, empirical studies and analyses, but in stories. And in those stories, there are songs, the song of life that's sung by Aslan as he brings the world into existence. Lewis apparently loved winged horses like Pegasus. I mean, we have that in The Great Divorce. We have Fledge in The Magician's Nephew. The old self being cast away and the new self that awaits for us. And like Job, it's only when we let go in humility that he could find the reward waiting for him, and that we can truly find ourselves. We're lucky to be blessed with an abundant, unearned grace that we have, life itself. We've been given so much. There's so much opportunity for us. We've also been shown how to take advantage of it, by looking along the beam, by immersing ourselves in the water. As Catholics, by letting Christ into our heart, where they can and he can bloom and blossom and bear our intended fruit. To explore the deeper meaning of the sacraments, the waters of baptism, the Eucharist, to repent of our pride, to embrace the Creator and Eternal Father, to enjoy the Job-like blessings that have been stored up for us, if we surrender our pride, where life is more solid and real, no longer mired in mere shadows of truth, we have this chance to spend eternity in the real thing. We started out our journey together on Theology Nights asking the question, what is truth? And I think we've experienced the joy of feeling and tasting that truth and feeling that truth in story, in imaginative writing. And with it, we have an imagined sense of the hoped-for joy that awaits us. Good news indeed. So thank you for being attentive for four sessions. So any questions or comments? We've got a few minutes left. Diane. How many pages? It's this big. Yeah, there's another copy. So 141 pages, but double-spaced and large print. It's a dream story. You can read it easily in a weekend. And once you start, I think you're going to keep going, because it's story after story. And the vision of, if you were going to write a story about hell, how would you tell that story? How would you talk about the gulf between heaven and hell? Would you have a magic bus, or would you have a wormhole, or how do you entangle those worlds? Would you entangle those worlds? Science fiction writing, interestingly, was, I may have said this before, but we take it for granted. But in the 50s and 60s, it was a relatively new genre, a new way of writing. And when Lewis and Tolkien first met, they decided they would get together with imaginative writing, and Lewis would write about time travel, and Tolkien would talk about different worlds in Middle Earth. They would kind of divide up how they'd go about doing things. And I think they did a wonderful job. Yes. Right, right. Yeah, his paintings are worth a lot more, too. Yeah. I think the question, there are two audiences, the British audience, the American audience. Screwtape Letters and The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe were the two most popular books in America. And the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe was well received in England, but increasingly so. Initially, it was sort of a slow build. There was an initial period of time where there was probably a small audience of devotees. But when word started to spread, and because the books are so approachable, and with the lectures that he gave, the Mere Christianity lectures, people learned about Lewis and were inquiring about him and found access to his works that way. So it's a gradual thing, and it continues. I mean, it continues. All his books are still in print. I mean, his estate, the foundation, makes millions, and I don't know how much money. Lots and lots of money. We got our daughter and son-in-law live in London now. We're planning to go visit and go to the kilns, and it's a pilgrimage I must make. So pick up some of these volumes. Start anywhere. But I recommend starting with the imaginative literature. But just as the angel was saying, all moments in time are one now, that's why it doesn't matter so much whether the magician's nephew is the first or the seventh book or the sixth book. It doesn't really matter, because it's all time. Lewis, interestingly, in Mere Christianity, talks about time with, I think, one of the best analogies about how a moment back in England could be 1,000 years in Narnia, Well, how can, you know, how can that be? Well, Lewis explains it this way. For the author of the book who wrote it, he can pick the book up. He can turn to any page at any time. He exists outside of time, outside of the time of the story, because he wrote the story. And so the characters in this story have to progress in a linear fashion from beginning to end, but the author doesn't. The author lives outside it. Another analogy he uses is the architect who builds a house. The architect can't become a part of the house. God created this universe, and he figured out a way to become a part of it. He's outside of time, and he found a way to get in the time of it. But all time is all at once, the Alpha, the Omega. An interesting thought to ponder. So thank you all. We'll see you in church. Thank you.